Chapter 93. I have been here a month and a half, and by testimony of friends, reinforced by personal experience, I now feel qualified to claim as an established fact that the telegraphic service here is the worst in the world except that Boston. These services are actually slower than was the New York and Hartford service in the days when I last complained to you, which was 15 or 18 years ago, when telegraphic time and try and time between the mentioned points was exactly the same, to wit, 3 hours and a half. 6 days ago it was that raw day which provoked so much comment. My daughter was on her way up from New York, and at noon she telegraphed me from New Haven asking that I meet her with a cloak at Portsmouth. Her telegram reached me 4 hours and a quarter later, just 15 minutes too late for me to catch my train and meet her. I judge that the telegram traveled about 200 miles. It is the best telegraphic work I have seen since I have been here, and I am mentioning it in this place not as a complaint, but as a compliment. I think a compliment ought always to precede a complaint, where one is possible, because it softens resentment and ensures for the complaint a courteous and gentle reception. Still, there is a detail or two connected with this matter which ought perhaps to be mentioned. And now, having smoothed the way with the compliment, I will venture them. The head corps in the York Harbor office sent me that telegram also. 1, he knew it would reach me too late to be of any value. 2, also, that he was going to send it to me by his boy. 3, that the boy would not take the trolley and come the 2 miles in 12 minutes, but would walk. 4, that he would be 2 hours and a quarter on the road. 5, and that he would collect 25 cents for transportation, for a telegram which he knew to be worthless, before he started it. From these data I infer that the Western Union owes me 75 cents, that is to say, the amount paid for combined wire and land transportation, a recoup provided for in the printed paragraph which heads the telegraph-blank. By these humane and Christian stages we now arrive at the complaint proper. We have had a grave case of illness in the family, and a relative was coming some 600 miles to help in the sick room during the convalescing period. It was an anxious time, of course, and I wrote and asked to be notified as to the hour of the expected arrival of this relative in Boston or in York Harbor. Being afraid of the telegraph, which I think ought not to be used in times of hurry and emergency, I asked that the desired message be brought to me by some swift method of transportation. By the milkman, if he was coming this way. But there are always people who think they know more than you do, especially young people, so of course the young fellow in charge of this lady used the telegraph. And at Boston, of all places, except York Harbor. The result was as usual, let me employ a statelier and exacter term, and say, historical. The dispatch was handed to the HC of the Boston office at 9 this morning. It said, shall bring a S to you 11:45 this morning. The distance traveled by the dispatch is 40 or 50 miles, I suppose, as the train time is 5 minutes short of 2 hours, and the trains are so slow that they can't give a WU telegram 2 hours and 20 minutes start and overtake it. As I have said, the dispatch was handed in at Boston at 9. The expected visitors left Boston at 9:40 and reached my house at 12 noon, beating the telegram 2 solid hours and 5 minutes over. The boy brought the telegram. It was bald-headed with age, but still legible. The boy was prostrate with travel and exposure, but still alive, and I went out to condole with him and get his last wishes and send for the ambulance. He was waiting to collect transportation before turning his passing spirit to less serious affairs. I found him strangely intelligent, considering his condition and where he is getting his training. I asked him at what hour the telegram was handed to the HC in Boston. He answered brightly that he didn't know. I examined the blank, and sure enough the wary Boston HC had thoughtfully concealed that statistic. I asked him at what hour it had started from Boston. He answered up as brightly as ever, and said he didn't know. I examined the blank, and sure enough the Boston HC had left that statistic out in the cold too. In fact, it turned out to be an official concealment. No blank was provided for its exposure. And none required by the law, I suppose. "'Tis a good one-sided idea," I remarked. "They can take your money and ship your telegram next year, if they want to. You've no redress. The law ought to extend the privilege to all of us." The boy looked upon me coldly. I asked him when the telegram reached York Harbor. He pointed to some figures following the signature at the bottom of the blank, too. 1:14. I said it was now 1:445 and asked, "Do you mean that it reached your morgue an hour and a half ago?" He nodded assent. It was at that time half an hour too late to be of any use to me, if I wanted to go and meet my people, which was the case, for by the wording of the message you can see that they were to arrive at the station at 11:445. "Why did your HC send me this useless message? Can't he read? Is he dead? It's the rules." "No, that does not account for it. Would he have sent it if it had been 3 years old, I in the meantime deceased, and he aware of it?" The boy didn't know. "Because, you know, a rule which required him to forward to the cemetery today a dispatch due 3 years ago, would be as good a rule as one which should require him to forward a telegram to me today which he knew had lost all its value an hour or two before he started it. The construction of such a rule would discredit an idiot. In fact, an idiot, I mean a common ordinary Christian idiot, you understand, would be ashamed of it, and for the sake of his reputation wouldn't make it. What do you think?" He replied with much natural brilliance that he wasn't paid for thinking. This gave me a better opinion of the commercial intelligence pervading his morgue than I had had before. It also softened my feelings toward him, and also my tone, which had hitherto been tinged with bitterness. "Let bygones be bygones," I said, gently. "We are all erring creatures, and mainly idiots, but God made us so, and it is dangerous to criticize. Sincerely, S50. Clemens." One day there arrived from Europe a caller with a letter of introduction from Elizabeth, Queen of Romania, better known as Carmen Silva. The visitor was Madame Hartwig, formerly an American girl, returning now, because of reduced fortunes, to find profitable employment in her own land. Her husband, a man of high principle, had declined to take part in an affair of honor, as recognized by the Continental Code, hence his ruin. Elizabeth of Romania was one of the most loved and respected of European queens and an author of distinction. Mark Twain had known her in Vienna. Her letter to him, and his own letter to the public, perhaps a second one, for its status 2 years later, follow herewith. From Carmen Silva to Mark Twain. Bucharest, May 9, 1902. "Honored Master, if I venture to address you on behalf of a poor lady who is stranded in Bucharest, I hope not to be too disagreeable. Mrs. Hartwig left America at the age of 14 in order to learn to sing, which she has done thoroughly. Her husband had quite a brilliant situation here till he refused to partake dans une affaire honorus, so it seems. They haven't a penny and each of them must try to find a living. She is very nice and pleasant and her school is so good that she most certainly can give excellent singing lessons. I beg your pardon for being a bore to one I so deeply love and admire, to whom I owe days and days of forgetfulness of self, and troubles and the intensest of all joys. Hero worship. People don't always realize what a happiness that is. God bless you for every beautiful thought you poured into my tired heart and for every smile on a weary way. Carmen Silva." From Mark Twain to the public. November 16, 1904. "To whom it may concern, I desire to recommend Madame Hartwig to my friends and the public as a teacher of singing and as a concert vocalist. as he has lived for 15 years at the court of Romania, and she brought with her to America an autograph letter in which Her Majesty the Queen of Romania cordially certified her to me as being an accomplished and gifted singer and teacher of singing, and expressed a warm hope that her professional venture among us would meet with success. Through absence in Europe, I have had no opportunity to test the validity of the Queen's judgment in the matter, but that judgment is the utterance of an entirely competent authority, the best that occupies a throne, and as good as any that sits elsewhere, as the musical world well knows, and therefore back it without hesitation, and endorse it with confidence. I will explain that the reason Her Majesty tried to do her friend a friendly office through me instead of through someone else was not that I was particularly the right or best person for the office, but because I was not a stranger. It is true that I am a stranger to some of the monarchs mainly through their neglect of their opportunities, but such is not the case in the present instance. The latter fact is a high compliment to me, and perhaps I ought to conceal it. Some people would. Mark Twain. Mrs. Clemens' improvement was scarcely perceptible. It was not until October that they were able to remove her to Riverdale, and then only in a specially arranged invalid car. At the end of the long journey, she was carried to her room, and did not leave it again for many months. To Rev. J. H. Twitchell, in Hartford. Riverdale, NY, October 31, 2002. Dear Joe, it is 10 days since Susie Twitchell wrote that you were laid up with a sprained shoulder, since which time we have had no news about it. I hope that no news is good news, according to the proverb. Still, authoritative confirmation of it will be gladly received in this family, if some of you will furnish it. Moreover, I should like to know how and where it happened. In the pulpit, as like as not, otherwise you would not be taking so much pains to conceal it. This is not a malicious suggestion, and not a personally invented one. You told me yourself, once, that you threw artificial power and impressiveness in two places in your sermons where needed, by hanging the Bible your own words. You have reached a time of life when it is not wise to take these risks. You would better jump around. We all have to change our methods as the infirmities of age creep upon us. Jumping around will be impressive now, whereas before you were gray it would have excited remark. Poor Livy drags along drearily. It must be hard times for that turbulent spirit. It will be a long time before she is on her feet again. It is a most pathetic case. I wish I could transfer it to myself. Between ripping and raging and smoking and reading, I could get a good deal of a holiday out of it. Clara runs the house smoothly and capably. She is discharging a trial-cook today and hiring another. A power of love to you all. Mark. Such was the state of Mrs. Clemens' health that visitors were excluded from the sick room, and even Clemens himself was allowed to see her no more than a few moments at a time. These brief, precious visits were the chief interests of his long days. Occasionally he was allowed to send her a few lines, reporting his occupations, and these she was sometimes permitted to answer. Only one of his notes has been preserved, written after a day, now rare, of literary effort. Its signature, the letter Y, stands for Auth, always her name for him. To Mrs. Clemens. Dear heart, I've done another full day's work, and finished before 4. I have been reading and dozing since, and would have had a real sleep a few minutes ago, but for an incursion, to bring me a couple of unimportant letters. I've stuck to the bed all day, and am getting back my lost ground. Next time I will be strictly careful, and make my visit very short, just a kiss and a rush. Thank you for your dear, dear note. You who are my own and only sweetheart. Sleep well. Y. XLII, Letters of 1903. To various persons. Hard days at Riverdale. Last summer at Elmira. the return to Italy, the reader may perhaps recall that H.H. Rogers, some 5 or 6 years earlier, had taken charge of the fortunes of Helen Keller, making it possible for her to complete her education. Helen had now written her first book, a wonderful book, The Story of My Life, and it had been successfully published. For a later generation, it may be proper to explain that the Miss Sullivan, later Mrs. Macy, mentioned in the letter which follows, was the noble woman who had devoted her life to the enlightenment of this blind, dumb girl, had made it possible for her to speak and understand, and, indeed, to see with the eyes of luminous imagination. The case of plagiarism mentioned in this letter is not now remembered, and does not matter, but it furnished a text for Mark Twain, whose remarks on the subject in general are eminently worthwhile. To Helen Keller, in Wrentham, Mass. Riverdale on the Hudson, St. Patrick's Day, 03. Dear Helen, I must steal half a moment from my work to say how glad I am to have your book, and how highly I value it, both for its own sake, and as a remembrance of an affectionate friendship which has subsisted between us for 9 years without a break, and without a single act of violence that I can call to mind. I suppose there is nothing like it in heaven, and not likely to be, until we get there and show off. I often think of it with longing, and how they'll say, there they come, sit down in front. I am practicing with a tin halo. You do the same. I was at Henry Rogers last night, and of course we talked of you. He is not at all well, you will not like to hear that, but like you and me, he is just as lovely as ever. I am charmed with your book, enchanted. You are a wonderful creature, the most wonderful in the world, you, and your other half together, Miss Sullivan, I mean, for it took the pair of you to make a complete and perfect whole. How she stands out in her letters. Her brilliance, eye, penetration, originality, wisdom, character, and the fine literary competencies of her pen, they are all there. Oh, dear me, how unspeakably funny, and owlishly idiotic, and grotesque was Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.